Hello and welcome to the Oxygen Addict podcast. We're brought to you every week by our sponsors, Precision Fuel and Hydration.com. You can personalize your fueling and hydration strategy so you perform at your best with 15% off the first order of electrolytes and carbohydrate fuel with the code OXYGEN24, Precision Fuel and Hydration.com. Welcome to the show, everybody. I'm your host, Coach Rob Wilby, and I'm joined by Coach Chris Palfreyman today. Chris, how are you doing?
Hey, Rob. I'm very well, thank you. Good to see you.
Good to see you as well, mate. Listen, everybody, every week we try and bring you an episode of this podcast to help motivate and inspire you for your triathlon endeavors this year. There's a couple of things you could do for us, please. If you like this episode and you enjoy it, please follow us on Spotify or Apple Podcasts and like and subscribe on YouTube. I was looking at our stats the other day and it's something like 15% of our listeners either follow us or subscribe on the YouTube channel, which is mind-blowing, really. If you're a person who watches and enjoys or listens and enjoys, clicking that like and subscribe button really helps the growth of the show. It helps the algorithm get the show shown to lots of other people. And I really believe that we can help a lot of people out here. So if you'd consider doing that for us, that'd be really awesome. And the second thing is, if you're looking for help and advice with your triathlon training, please get in touch. You can go to our website at team.oxygenaddict.com. You can read all about the different coaching options we've got there and the different packages available. And if what you read there looks good to you, either drop us an email to help@oxygenaddict.com or there's a link in the show notes. You can book a call with us and we can have a chat and see how we can best help you out with your triathlon training goals for this year. Right then, Chris. So this episode today, I want this episode to be something that both our coached athletes and also listeners who are not coached by us can get a lot from. And the focus of it is talking about, I'm going to be very careful with choosing my words here. I was originally going to call this about testing week, but I've decided to step away from that because it brings up so many different emotions for people. And that's the first thing for us to talk about. So we're going to talk about the end of the winter block, which is our big phase of winter training that's coming to an end over the next few weeks for the majority of the athletes we coach. I know a lot of non-coached athletes are also coming to the end of that phase as well. So we're going to review that block. We're going to talk about the effect of testing at the end of it. And then we're also going to look forward as to the race-specific block of training that's upcoming, how that's going to be similar, how it's going to be different, and some common pitfalls for people along the way as we're moving into our main chunk of the race-specific training for the year. So that's the first thing I want us to talk about, actually, Chris, is it's kind of the word that can become a big, scary word for a lot of athletes. It's testing. And it surprised me over the years, the number of athletes for whom testing becomes the monster under the bed. It becomes the thing that they're really afraid of. And my intention along the way and our intention as coaches is it for not to be that. It's not A-levels. It's not a thing that you stand or fall on and get to go to university if your results are good or not. I simply want athletes to see it as a way to check that the levels that they're training at going forward are correct relative to their current fitness. But it's a big challenge for people to see it that way, isn't it?
Yeah, totally. And I find it quite interesting because I think the majority of our athletes, at least, they get really excited about race day. And we don't get that many messages or conversations just before the race saying, I'm crippled with anxiety on this one. I'm not going to turn up. But the amount of messages we get before an FTP test is huge and it's far greater. So I do think we maybe need to change the conversation around testing in inverted commas. And I think actually, if we asked our athletes to do a 20-minute big effort on the bike, they'd all rub their hands thinking, oh, this is great. A bit of variety in the session. I can absolutely smash it. For once, I don't have a ceiling on the watts that I can put out. And I think that the majority of athletes would get excited. But as soon as we use the word test, suddenly everyone gets a little bit crippled. So maybe that's one way to approach it. A training session, because we know that there are benefits from doing a really hard 20-minute effort. There isn't a pass or fail element to it, so therefore the word test isn't the most relevant term to use. And if we can get excited about race day, I feel that we can also get excited about a training session and a really exciting one, which is essentially pushing yourself to the limit for a certain period of time. I don't know, how would you approach it, Rob, on that sense?
I totally agree. And I think that's the message we want to get across to athletes. It's that the world isn't hanging in the balance on the result of either a bike test or a swim test or a run test. It's simply an ability to check where you're up to and make sure that your numbers are correct going forwards. And the reality for the majority of our athletes is numbers are going to go up as well as down across time. For athletes who are relatively new to the sport, there's an almost sort of 3-year guaranteed upward trend. But it's been my experience that outside of that first 3 years of training, where for a lot of athletes, it seems like the gains, they don't come easy, but they certainly come easier than they do later on in your athletic career. Once you're outside of that initial 3 years, I think you have to let go of that idea that we're always going to get bigger test numbers. And we've got to move towards the idea of we're simply testing just so that we know our training is at the right intensity going forward, because it's all about being efficient and it's all about not wasting your precious training time. And it's all about saying, if you've only got 1 hour to do this session this week, I want to make sure that the session that you're doing is as relevant to you as it can possibly be. And just like I would say to an athlete, you know, if we set you a target of 200 watts, I don't want you doing 210 watts. That isn't better. That's wrong. Do what you're asked to do. It's exactly the same with a test. It's just making sure that the levels athletes are working at are going to be relevant. And if people approach it with that mindset, then happy days. I think you can let go of a lot of that anxiety that can actually mess people's performances up as well.
Yeah. My kind of finishing point on testing, especially when it comes to the bike, which I think is the hardest one to get right, is all around pacing. And I think we all shoot for our optimal, what we think our threshold is. And we always try and sneak in an extra 5 or 10 watts in those first 10 minutes thinking, this could be my day. I feel as if I deserve those watts because I've put in all the hard work over these 8 to 12 weeks. But actually, I feel that you're going to screw yourself over. Those first 10 minutes should be really comfortable. And if you're doubting whether actually you could be pushing a little bit more in those first 10 minutes, the reality is you've probably got it right, because those last 10 minutes are where it really stings. But if it's stinging in those first 10 minutes, the likelihood is there's going to be a big drop off in power at the end. So I think as you walk towards the bike for the FTP test in particular, you've basically got 2 or 3 objectives. One is to start the test, which I know sounds silly, but we have a lot of athletes who actually, they walk toward the bike and they think, no, I'm going to come up with an excuse in inverted commas to not do this. So you have to start. And once you start, you have to finish it. They're the first 2 objectives. Anything outside of that is a bonus. If you find that actually the FTP recalibration or test, whatever we want to call it, is crippling, I wouldn't be against the idea of an athlete doing it totally blind in terms of hide the watts. You don't need to know the watts. Rob just said it really clearly that actually it's not a pass or fail. We don't particularly need to know the watts as you're doing it. And the FTP number is going to come out at the end of that 20 minutes. Doesn't matter what it is, update your training peaks and off you go. It doesn't matter if you haven't got that increase that you so hope. That will come with time. So I think for me, that's my biggest thing as a coach. I want to see an athlete start, finish, give 100% effort. And then whatever the outcome is, it doesn't matter.
And I think we can apply this. If we talk about the swim test for a little while and then we apply the same logic to the bike test, there's an interesting parallel here. So with the swim test, I'm going to say you can't see how fast you're swimming. I suppose we're getting to the point these days where people who've got form goggles or are using some kind of tech can actually see the pace. But let's say for a minute, you're not swimming with that stuff. The advice we always give to someone doing a 400 meters is you need that first quarter to feel relatively easy. If you feel as though you're pushing in the first quarter or even in the first half, it's going to be a very, very difficult test. And so that's exactly the same for a bike test or a run test. The first quarter to the first half needs to feel, it's going to feel fast, but it needs to feel relatively comfortable. And then the second half is just going to be do whatever you can do to get through it. And it's the second half that's really going to be there. So swim tests are a lot harder because you don't have that sort of way to easily hold yourself back. And often we do hear from athletes. I remember, you know, years of standing on pool deck and watching the clock as people are doing a 400 meters. Almost every athlete swims the first 100 faster than the rest of it, even if they're absolutely dedicated to slowing themselves down and holding themselves back. And I used to do a thing with some of the trainee coaches I worked with, which was to get them to watch the clock. And we'd have a rough idea how fast an athlete was coming in the 400. And we'd split that into 100 meter chunks. And we would say, for example, right, this athlete is shooting to swim 8 minutes for the 400. So they should be coming through the 100 meter mark in somewhere around 1:55 to 2 minutes. If they come through in 1:45, stop them. We had the coaches holding a kickboard, and they'd reach into the water and stick it in the water in front of the athlete. And the athletes knew they'd blown it. They'd gone too hard in the first 100, and we'd give them a 5 or 10 minute break, send them back in to do it again. Because if you do that first quarter of your test far too fast, even if it doesn't feel fast because of adrenaline, your physiology still knows what's going on and you're going to blow up during it. So I love your idea of doing it blind. If you're doing a bike test with a power meter, I love the idea of doing it blind. But the caveat here is a lot of athletes, especially the ones that are sort of younger in athletic years, they don't know the bodies well enough yet to know how easy and steady feels. So I think the power meter can be a good guide to that. And a rough rule of thumb is, whatever your FTP is at the moment, if you set out at 105% of that number for the first quarter, first half, if you did 105% for the whole 20 minutes, you'd come in with the same result you had last time, right? So that's kind of your starting point. And almost everybody isn't going to struggle to hit 105, but they are going to feel they're being held back. And that's kind of a little tool. And I'm a big fan of using the power meter as a tool to help people cheat, essentially. It's like legal cheating. Use it as feedback on what you're doing right now, because it's giving you a number that tells you what you're doing, not your brain is telling you how you're feeling, right? So there's the two separate things there. But yeah, I think your key point is absolutely key there. If we talk about benchmarking rather than testing, we're just making sure that athletes' numbers going forward are reasonable and sensible, and that we know what people are going to take going forwards.
I feel like we could talk about this forever. I've got quite a few more points, so yeah. I don't want to take up the whole episode, but I think it's quite an important one because a lot of testing is about to happen, especially with our athletes. Another point when it comes to getting a validated test is to make sure that we're replicating everything from the last test. So to make sure that you can compare results, you obviously have to create an environment that you can compare week after week or year after year. So ideally, our athletes are making notes in their training peak saying, this was my protocol, this was the rough temperature, this is the time of day, this is what I ate, this is how much caffeine I had, this is how I slept. Because actually all those points might have an effect on heart rate, perceived effort, and at the end of the day, power output. So if there's an external factor that's going to change these things, then put a note in, because that's really useful for us as the coaches to have a look, but also the athlete needs to kind of, I think, take responsibility for the testing they're doing, because at the end of the day, it's their benchmark and they're the ones that are going to feel it going forward. So I think creating that kind of benchmark that is something you can replicate going forward is really important. So if you know you've got a test coming up, make sure that you have all that set up now. If you used a fan last time, but the fan has broken since, now's the time to fix the fan. If you were using a heart rate strap and the battery's gone since then, change the battery. All those silly things, make sure your turbo trainer is calibrated, power meter calibrated, all that stuff that hopefully you did last time, make sure that you do this time again. Rob, in terms of bike testing, which bike should people do it on? We speak to a lot of athletes that are in a really great position where they've actually got multiple bikes. Do you have an opinion on which bike they do it on, whether it's a triathlon specific bike, a TT bike, or a road bike? Or actually, are you going to say what we just spoke about, which is whatever you did last time?
Yeah.
Over to you.
So from the perspective of, we are looking to get benchmarks relative to the training you've just done in your winter block, use the same bike that you've used to do all your training on. Okay. And that means same bike, same position, aero or sitting up, whichever you've been doing, same power meter. I'm just going to go back for a minute because I think this is so important. You mentioned a second ago calibrating the power meter. A little anecdote here from one of our athletes who got in contact with me and said, you know, for the last 3 weeks, I am just a useless athlete. I cannot hit the power numbers. I have no idea what's going on. I had a really good test 3 weeks ago and I'm just useless. I'm giving up the sport essentially, which is obviously a heartbreaking thing for a coach to hear. And when we dug into it a little bit, we went back and 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 checked all of these things were all equal. And the last thing that I thought to check with was this athlete was, can I just check you are calibrating your power meter before every ride? And this athlete said, no, should I be? And so that's something I want people who are listening to get. If you are riding with a power meter, calibrate it before every single ride. So if you're new to power meters and you don't know how that's done, it's dead, dead simple. It's just done with a press of a couple of buttons using your Garmin or head unit. But the power meter works on strain gauges. Strain gauges are affected by temperature. Temperature changes pretty much every day. You need to calibrate it before every ride. So what had happened in this athlete's case was the power meter hadn't been calibrated. The athlete's equipment had gone outside into a garage. It was really cold. Numbers were all over the place. So some days the power came really easy. Some days the power was impossible to hit. And it's all down to that calibration. So make sure they're doing that. And then secondly, to your point about different bikes, I'm a massive, massive fan of training for your sort of your winter intensity block. Train on the turbo trainer in the same position on the same bike every single time. And like you've said, I've got athletes who are fortunate enough to have a gym with a watt bike over here that they use on a Tuesday and their home setup that they use over here on a Thursday. I've seen evidence of those numbers being 30 watts, 40 watts out between the different equipment. And if that's the case, you need a different FTP test on a different machine to know what your numbers are on the different machines. And so really important that you keep as many things the same as you can do to really validate the fact that you've made progress or not. So.
Anecdotally, I also had a conversation with an athlete this week who's new to training with our team. And unfortunately, they did their FTP test with erg mode on, which essentially is capping the amount of power that you can put out, which is really frustrating because we want to see your maximal capacity for that 20 minutes. So that's
talk
another
about
really
erg mode, Chris. Let's go through that. Talk about what erg mode is on a turbo trainer and why it just isn't an option for doing FTP tests on.
So an erg mode is basically on any what's called a smart trainer, which essentially is a turbo trainer that allows you to have variance in power. But there is an option for you with a smart trainer to click a button on your computer or your phone that has erg mode on or off. If you have erg mode off, you'll essentially be riding to your own power. You can, if you pedal really hard, your power will go through the roof. If you pedal really softly, your power will be really low. Absolutely fine. It's like riding on the road. However, with erg mode on, suddenly the computer is going to cap you at, let's say, 200 watts. If you pedal like an absolute maniac, your cadence will go up, but you'll still be at 200 watts. Or if you pedal really, really, really slowly, your power is still going to be exactly 200 watts. You can't deviate from that. And it's a crazy feeling. For some intervals, that can be really useful. And that's essentially why it's been designed to hold you exactly where you want to be for a specific interval. However, the FTP test is all about working out what your maximal output is without any assistance from software. So when you do your FTP test, make sure you have erg mode off, and then you can play around with erg mode with certain sessions. FTP sessions can be a really good way to ease yourself into. But essentially for the FTP, we want your natural cadence. So if usually you're around 80 RPM, let's say, whether you're indoors or outdoors, great. That's your natural cadence. Aim to do that in the FTP test. And in terms of power, well, you won't have erg mode on, which will mean that the harder you pedal, the higher the power up.
Yeah. I'm going to interject here as well. And because I'm an old bugger and I get to be opinionated these days, I'm going to say I would much prefer it if all athletes turned erg mode off and ignored it forever and pretended it didn't exist. And the reason for that is when you go to race, you need to get used to the feeling of controlling the power that you're putting out. And that takes concentration. Now, it has its uses, but in almost all the instances of problems that we've found in athletes whose races haven't gone the way we've wanted to, the fact they've trained with erg mode on has been a contributing factor to it along the way. I think that's a fair way of stating it, isn't it, Chris? So
yeah, totally.
I think you're doing yourself a favor by making your body learn how to control the power and learning what it feels like and learning the variance between cadence going down a little bit. Just turn erg mode off and get rid of it. And it's very interesting to us, despite us writing down in the instructions for how to do the workouts and the tests and stuff, despite it clearly saying that in there, turn it off, people don't see that, or people don't read it, or people don't take that in. And it can be quite frustrating from a coaching point of view when the problem is something that you've foreseen and put a thing in place and said, don't do this thing. And then they've gone, oh, I did this thing. Should I have done this thing? So check the instructions in your workouts as well, because whether you're coached by us or coached by somebody else, the chances are somebody's thought of this challenge that you're going to face already, and we can kind of get over some of those hurdles for you. But yeah, I think that's a really good point. The getting around of the erg mode thing is.
I think a final little detail around erg mode is when you're doing the testing, and for the majority of your intervals, to be honest, if you've got erg mode off, which is what we're promoting, make sure that you do it on a flat course, even online, even in Zwift, because suddenly if you're doing it on a really hilly course, it means that you're probably going to go downhill at times and it's impossible to put your maximal power out on a long downhill. So find the flattest course possible. You can filter in Zwift, for example, and find the flattest course possible, which is what we want. We want a steady state, maximal effort for 20 minutes.
I think Zwift also has the option to turn the effective hills off, doesn't it? And that's really useful for a testing day. I know a lot of people like that. And the whole point of the smart trainer is it replicates hills indoors for you. But for the purpose of testing, I don't think there's a better thing produced than an old school turbo. I think the fact that you've just got to close your eyes, grit your teeth and get on with it, really, really useful. Is there anything else you can think of to mention on FTP baselining other than to say to people, you know, we take care of the preparation, we make sure we've got calibrations, we get our head right going into it. And then really, it's just a matter of letting the cards fall where they may. That's the big part, isn't it?
Yeah. I don't think I'm going to lead people down the wrong road here, but I've done loads of FTP tests in my time, and I found it quite useful to go back to my previous test. And obviously, try and match the same protocol in terms of time of day and temperature, all that stuff, but also learn from either what I did well or what didn't go so well in that test. So you can go into your Training Peaks, go into the files and see what happened in those first 7 or 10 minutes and remember how that felt, because I know loads of times I thought I was going to be on a magic day and shoot for my PB. But actually, it's very rare that that happens because I'm carrying training load and fatigue, which you all are as well, because we don't want to taper too much into an FTP test. So try and learn what you did from your pacing last time. And there'll be elements that were good and elements that you can learn from, but make sure you learn from them. Don't just ignore the last test. You've already got a blueprint to go from. So maybe what you can do is highlight the first 10 minutes, see what you did, see what your cadence was, see what your power was, and see whether at what point there was a bit of a drop off. And if you know that there was a drop-off, then that is clearly a sign that maybe you started too hard. So then into this test, if you held, let's say, 200 watts, maybe start at 190 and build your way in. And then you can fully express your aerobic fitness in the last 10 minutes, which is what this test is all about. The first 10 minutes is kind of symbolic. It's just getting you through that first 10 minutes. The last 10 minutes is where we want to produce some really good watts. So have a look at your last test and learn from it.
Yeah. And I think to just paint a picture of what this should look like. The perfect FTP test is going to have a level power output for 20 minutes. It's going to be almost exactly flat for the full 20 minutes. Two classic mistakes that I see when I look at people's power files is an FTP test where the power's really high for the first minute and then levels out and then fades off. If you go out far too hard, all you're doing in terms of physiology is you're flooding your body with lactic acid, and that makes it really, really difficult to put out any kind of meaningful test. And the other mistake that I see people do is they've gone out and they've held a level that is quite a bit below what they could actually have held. And then over the last 3 minutes, the power goes right up at the end and there's a massive jump. And I'm talking in some cases, I've seen people go 50, 60, 80 watts harder for the last 3 or 4 minutes. That's indicative of, well, okay, you're still learning how to do an FTP test. You could definitely do more next time. Okay, so with athletes we coach, we can kind of manually manipulate those numbers a little bit, but it gives people an insight into the kind of athletic personality they are, whether they're a go out too hard, whether they go out too conservative. The last thing I want to touch on with bike FTP benchmarking is the question of cadence. It's people saying, what is the right cadence? What should I do? Is it okay that? So I'm going to put people's minds at rest. Whatever feels right for you is going to be right for you. And for the majority of people, that's going to fall somewhere into the sort of 75 to 95 revs a minute. That's probably where the fat part of the bell curve is. If you're going any slower than 75 revs a minute, the chances are that you can shift a little bit more of the load to your lungs and your heart by pedaling a bit faster. And if you're going much above 95, I think there's some strength development work to be done there to help bring that cadence down a little bit. But that'll put sort of some numbers on it for people and also reassure people that, you know, what they're doing is, for most people, form fits function, and what you're doing works for you for that reason.
Really good point.
Let's talk a little bit about swim testing. I think that the swim test is something that it can be an interesting and very rewarding opportunity for people who've managed to get to the pool a lot during the winter. It can be something that unfortunately doesn't always show the fruits of somebody's labor across the winter, we'll put it that way. And even more so than an FTP test, don't want people to be thinking that their swimming success rises or falls on the CSS test. It's a really useful little benchmark, but that's all it is. And so again, typically athletes in the first 3 years of training, they might see some big forward leaps in their swimming and big chunks of time coming off. It might be that that plateaus over time. And it might even be that you do a CSS test and the numbers come out slower than before. So if you're not making the gains that you hope you had, I guess we're here to reassure people and say, we've seen that happen before. Swimming is a very, very skill-based sport. There's a much greater skill element than there is a fitness element in it. And the skill element doesn't always work every day, does it? You've used the analogy before of tennis, and I've used the analogy of golf. I can go down the driving range some evenings and be convinced I'm on the PGA Tour next week. And other evenings, I can hit the ball with the driver and literally bounce the ball off the roof of the shed above me, right? I do not know enough about my body to know what I'm doing right or wrong on any given day. It's exactly the same with swimming. Most of us don't know why we're swimming well when we are and why we're swimming badly when we are.
I found the swim test much harder than the FTP test. I think a lot of athletes listening, we're essentially land-based mammals and we feel more comfortable when we have access to oxygen at all times of day. Put me into the water and suddenly there's an element of panic and breathing and all sorts of things happen. So the mentality I had when I was doing a CSS test was not swim as hard as you can, because that put me into the same mentality that I had for an FTP test, which was essentially trying as hard as I could. But I know that when I'm in the water, if I try as hard as I can, I end up splashing everywhere and my technique falls apart and I don't actually swim faster for more effort. So the idea that I had from my own approach was it was an opportunity to test my technique under stress. And that's what it was. It wasn't swim as hard as I can. It was how can I implement my technique to the best of my ability under a little bit more load than maybe what I've been doing in previous sessions. And that's all it was. And the fastest times that I ever swam were, honestly, they felt the easiest. It's the strangest thing and very, very hard to convey to an athlete who hasn't had that experience yet, because we all try and put in more effort and we understand that. But the moment your technique breaks down, even by a percent here or a percent there, that has a knock-on effect on other elements of your stroke, and suddenly that 1% turns into 10%, and the whole thing falls apart. So if I can kind of convey any shared wisdom on it, is look for the squeakiest, cleanest technique that you've ever done for the longest period of time over that 400 and 200. And yeah, you can build the effort slowly but surely as you get through the distance, but don't be looking to do that straight away. Look for the absolute perfect YouTube style swim technique that you've got and pretend you're being filmed. Make it silly, because the more eyes that you feel that are on your stroke, the more focused you can be on the stroke as opposed to on the effort. So yeah, I share your pain, athletes, on this one. I've been through many CSS tests myself, and I know that my fastest times have been the smoothest, the most controlled, the most consistent, where I was hardly chasing the pace or the effort at all. It just came naturally.
Yeah. And I think we'll go on to talk a little bit later on as we talk about the shift into the race-specific block. We'll talk then about why we no longer use the CSS test in that block and what we do. What we do instead of that. But yeah, give it a go. I think that's the best attitude. Remember what we said, hold yourself back in the first quarter, push yourself on in the last half, and just see where the numbers come out. And if you're one of the sort of newer to swimming athletes, or an athlete who goes through phases of swimming and not swimming, then you might find that, you know, your swim's gone forward, it's come back, maybe it goes forward again. If you're a long-term consistent swimmer, you're probably not going to see a huge change in your numbers, and that's okay. It's just validating where your numbers are at to move forwards. And that's...
Here's an interesting point. I had a conversation with a new athlete last week or the week before, and I found it really interesting because it was a new one to me that I hadn't really thought of. And it very much in line with what we were saying about FTP testing, making sure that the protocol was the same. And actually, it goes, that stands strong in terms of swimming as well. And this athlete was doing all of their swim training in a 25-meter pool, and then they thought that they'd go and do their CSS test in a 50-meter pool because it's a magical pool and they had access to it. But the reality is, all we're trying to do is benchmark your CSS for the training that you're going to be doing. We're not looking for a PB. If we're looking for a PB, we'd go and do it in a 10 meter. That's not the point. We want you to go and replicate it in a pool that you're going to be doing all your swim training in. And it's crazy to think that actually some pools, even of the same length pools, some pools are faster than others. And so whichever pool you're going to be doing the majority of your training in is the pool that you should be doing your CSS test in, even if it's the slowest pool that you've got. And pool depth and the sides of the pool and the temperature of the pool, all those things actually play a pretty significant part into how quick that pool is. But I think it's really important to reassure the athletes that it doesn't matter what the time is, as long as it's the pool that you're going to be using the majority of your training.
Yeah, and for people who are listening who are unaware of this, the pool length does play a difference in how fast you'll swim. If you usually swim in a 25-meter pool and you swim 2 minutes 100, if you go and swim in a 50-meter pool, you're not going to be swimming 2 minutes 100. It's probably going to be more like 210 or 215 100. The effect of having the extra two wall flips in there is massive on the swim speed. And if you talk with people from a swimming background, I had no idea about this when I started, and they would talk about long course meters and short course meters, and that's why. The times that you swim are very, very different. So stick to the same pool, exactly as you've said. And just to wrap up the section on bench lining and testing at the end of winter, if we talk about our bench line run session, we've already addressed some of the challenges that affect the other tests by the fact that our run test isn't a flat out run test. It's going to be a sub-maximal run test. So it's not about pushing yourself absolutely as fast as you can. But I think the thing that's most important to take away from what we've said with the other things is trying to get the conditions the same, trying to get the course the same as last time is really important. Because if it's really, really, really windy outside on the day you do the test, it is going to affect your timings. If you're running on a very different course to last time, it is going to affect your timings. So I'd encourage everyone to have their own course that they run. If they can run laps of a mile-ish around the local where they live, that's perfect, because any wind conditions, you'll have it behind you in one way and you'll have it in front of you in another direction. But running laps is a really good way to do that. So again, what we're looking for with our submax run test is either that an athlete's heart rate is going to be lower for a given pace, or they run at the same heart rate they got to last time and they see that their pace is faster than last time. And I've actually got a little personal story on this one, Chris. I went out, you remember me a couple of months ago telling you how delighted I was that I'd done a sub 25 minute 5K. And that was my giving it the full beans. It was as hard as I dared push myself. Today I ran a 25 minute 25K with my heart rate sat at 140, which for me is my aerobic run numbers. So it's, and that's not to brag or anything, but it's to show people we've got this ability to go from a couple of months ago, something being what feels like a pretty full on tempo effort, to a very similar paced run, feeling pretty much easy pace heart rate. For me, the difference is massive. If I go just a little bit faster than e-pace, the world's going to end very quickly. I can tell that. But we can make massive progress. And that's really good for me because I, my situation, I can't push myself really hard. But I can now see progress even at a submaximal level. Whereas if the only thing I had was racing, I would never feel as though I'm making any progress. And I think that's a big thing for athletes. You need to feel as though you're making progress with your running. And if your coaching team is saying to you, just trust us, running at a steady pace is going to have a good effect. People need more than trust. You know, it's not a cult in Southern California, is it, at the end of the day? People need to see progress. And that's the progress they're going to see in this submax run test this time.
That's a really good point. I feel that we've spoken about swim and bike quite a bit. And I think we should probably highlight a few of the nuances of the run test, like you were just doing there, Rob. Because heart rate is such an important metric in this specific test, we know that heart rate fluctuates so much for so many different reasons, whether it's temperature, emotions, fatigue, excitement, all sorts, caffeine. So again, it stands really strong to go back at your last test, see what time of day you did. I know that if I go for a run at 6 a.m. versus 6 p.m, naturally my heart rate is different. So what I try and do is replicate the time of day. Also, the day of the week can make quite a big difference. If you do it after a really long, stressful day at work full of meetings and then coming back, commuting, and then doing your run, the likelihood is that your heart rate is already going to be under more stress than it was on a Sunday morning, waking up in your own time, having a casual breakfast, and then going for your run. So all those little things, whatever you did last time, try and replicate it this time. And don't try and cheat the system by, oh, well, I did it on a Thursday last time, I'll do it on a Sunday this time to try and get my heart rate low. That's, you know, you're tricking yourself. What you want to do is replicate whatever you did last time and actually see what the difference is there. So nutrition, hydration, time of day, the same equipment. So you don't want to be choosing a carbon shoe if you chose a heavy training shoe last time. I know it sounds like a small detail, but you can easily find some free time in that. Yeah. And use that for race day. You don't need to be, you know, doing PBs on a submaximal test. So it's all those little points. But I think if you add all those points up, it could make quite a big difference to either your heart rate or your pace. And we're not looking for that. We're looking for a standardized test that you can replicate each time.
Yeah. And we can also take this one step further. I think it's great to talk about doing a test at the end of a block. But with the running and the heart rate in particular, I'm a really big fan of people looking at their data after each run. Look at the pace you did, look at the heart rate you did in those sections, and get a feel for what you run at your e-pace. And you'll have some bad days and you'll have some good days. And if you discount those, the ones in the middle give you a good, you know, I I know for sure, if we go back 6 months, it was a real struggle for me to keep my heart rate below 165 going out for an easy run. And now my heart rate's sitting down at 140. Now, I think my data is massively skewed compared to the normal healthy athletic community because it's like a coming back from illness thing. But for most people, I think it's really good to, you know, glance down when you go to check your pace and see what your heart rate's doing and get a feel for that when you come back. And then the looking at the data becomes, what did they used to say in schools? Assessment of progress rather than assessment for progress, one or the other. You know, you know that you're making progress because you're looking at how you've done every session rather than doing a test to see whether you've made progress along the way. Okay, so the testing block, the baselining block is going to form, if you like, it's going to form the marker of the end of the winter block and the shift from our winter philosophy into our race-specific philosophy. And not everyone's going to make that shift at the same time, but I think it's worth talking people through. You know, athletes coached by us are going to have a plan in place and that break will fall where it does. Athletes who are not coached, often the questions I get emailed through from people are, what would be the appropriate time to move from an FTP-focused winter build into a race-specific build? When should we do that? So let's put some numbers on that. For Ironman distance athletes, we're looking at roughly 16 to 20 weeks before the Ironman, we should make the shift onto a race-specific block. For 70.3 athletes, it can be a bit closer to the event. So it's 12 to 16 weeks before the event day. For short course athletes doing sprint and Olympic, you can make the shift at 8 to 12 weeks before race day. And then that's where you can have your shift in the two training philosophies. And the thing that's generally different when we move from winter into the race-specific block is we're going to make the race-specific block, no surprise here, it's going to become, the training becomes more specific to goal event in terms of duration and intensity. So if you're racing long distance, your training sessions are going to shift towards being less intense, but longer. And if you're racing short course, your sessions or your key sessions are going to shift towards being shorter and higher intensity. And if people stick to those general principles, it kind of filters out all of the noise that they're going to see on social media. Because if you're racing Ironman, it becomes obvious your important sessions are going to be your longer, steady runs, rides, and swims. And if you're racing short course, it's your higher intensity runs, rides, and swims, and everything in between. And people then don't need to worry about different philosophies, different ways of training. It's the most specific session works for you at the most specific time. And if we can give people one takeaway to think about, it's that the biggest mistake we see people making is going too hard on their long, steady sessions and not having enough energy then to go the appropriate intensity on the harder sessions that we do set people. That's the really big trap to avoid, isn't it?
I think the timeline that you spoke of is a good anchoring point for the athletes that are listening, because it's very easy to jump to the conclusion of, all right, Coach Rob is telling me, if I'm a self-coached athlete, that I should now be, let's say we're doing an Ironman specific from after my test. Well, yeah, but you've really got to build really slowly and progressively into that. And recovery is a massive part that you need to feed in. But I know that a lot of athletes are going to hear that and they're going to think, right, well, I'm going to start running maybe 20 miles this weekend, next weekend, 25 miles, then maybe 30 miles, add a big bike off. You know, it suddenly becomes a monstrously big amount of volume that isn't what we want to be doing as age group athletes. So using that 16 to 20 week rough guideline is something that you can use to anchor yourself of, okay, well, I've got that 16 to 20 week period to progressively, slowly but surely build that volume towards the really race specific stuff I'm going to be doing. Because if you start skipping some progressive load and some stepping stone, that's a sure way to either be burnt out or start to be injured. And to be honest, you're just not going to absorb the amount of training that you're going to ask your body to absorb. And so it's a really, really slippery slope. And that's where I think the magic of having a coach really comes in. It's this specific period of time when we have that big looming scary Iron Man looking at us down the tunnel, and we're thinking, I haven't even done more than 13 miles on the run, or I haven't even done more than 3 and a bit hours on the bike. Maybe I should be doing 6 hours on the bike now. Maybe I should be doing 20 miles on the run now. No, please don't. We want you to be really fit and healthy on race day. And the way to do that is to progressively build that through that 16 to 20 week block and making sure that recovery doesn't slip down the priority list, which it often does when you're self-coached.
Yeah. I'm going to give you an interesting anecdote here, Chris. I, as you know, I do not like social media, and I do not go on Instagram myself at all. It's not on my phone. It's not on my computer. It's not a thing that I use. And so I very rarely go on and see what's going on there. And I went on today, and I mean, I know this, but oh my God, what a bin fire Instagram is. If you were a beginner triathlete today and you were inspired to do an event and you started following the people who are good at this sport and you used them as a model for how to train, it blew my mind with some of the sessions that you see. It feels like every pro triathlete and decent age grouper has got an Instagram account these days, and they're posting videos and photos of themselves training and telling people what they're doing. Like, for the love of God, do not try and model what the top people are doing, because I think it's the one area where if someone's read Malcolm Gladwell, they've gone, okay, I need my 10,000 hours and I need to model excellence on what the excellent people are doing. That's the pinnacle of the sport. It's not the starting point, and you can get yourself in so much trouble. And to be fair to a lot of the pro athletes, especially, they're not saying do what I do, but there's a big crossover of some good age group athletes who are competitive, who are also doing some coaching in inverted commas, giving people advice, giving out generic, here's a great training session. You know, there was one that I saw that was like, here's a great threshold run session for Ironman training. And it was like a load of super skinny guys without shirts on a track running around, you know, killing each other. And I was thinking, man, it's so far from what the important stuff is for people. And I get it. Like, if your currency is likes and clicks and hearts, of course you're going to put the sexy stuff up there without your shirt on, with you running around without a tan. But that's not the thing that's going to get the majority of busy working professional age groupers with families fit. So just don't copy the bin fire. That would be my plea to people.
Well, I think you made a good point that we're talking about being race specific in this block. And for those really, let's call them the skinny topless guys running, I don't know what they're running, but they'll be running fast, really fast. They're probably running really fast on race day too, and that's okay. Leave them to do that and applaud them as they do it. It's unbelievable what some athletes are doing.
And it's appropriate to them.
It's race specific for them, but it's not race specific for me or you or to the listener necessarily. So 100%. You've got to think about what your race specificity is. And I'm going to say that the average, finger in the air, most athletes aren't running faster than a 4-hour marathon on the likes of Ironman Wales. So therefore, we're not going to send you
a very good marathon, wouldn't it, at Ironman Wales? That would be a top 15% run time and I think that would surprise people listening who've not looked at the results. I think people assume people run a lot faster in a marathon than they actually do in an Ironman.
No, totally. And, you know, I've done Ironman Wales and it was by far my slowest run, but that doesn't mean it was my worst run. It was an okay run on that specific course, but it was never going to look good on Instagram. Or if someone asked me, oh, what's your marathon run pace specifically for that event? It's really not impressive. What's impressive is doing it after manic sea swim, after some crazy hills and wind on the bike, and then doing that. So that was my race specificity. It wasn't fast, but it was strong from the start of the marathon through to the end. Anyone can look good for 5K, more or less. If you train for 5K, you're always going to look good as a runner. But we're race specific to multiple hours and hours and hours on end, and then still trying to be running strong at the end. So have a think of what race specificity is for you and be really honest with yourself. And if 5 hours is a good benchmark for you to run that at the end of an Ironman off the bike, then that's your pace.
Yeah.
We're not looking to be topless around a track smashing some 400s and 800s. That's not for us, I'm afraid. It's a different sport.
I've got a photograph of myself from the World Championships in 2008 running next to an American guy who I got chatting to, and we were both having horrible races for different reasons. I'd blown myself up on the bike, my stomach had shut down, I was in a whole world of pain, and I was just trying to get to the finish line. It was 35 degrees and baking. The guy I was running next to, his seat post had snapped on the bike, and he'd done, I can't remember what, like a considerable amount, 40K without a seat post, riding out the saddle on the Almere course, which is pan flat. And so we're chatting as we run around, and he said to me, "Do you know what? I was in really great shape for this race, and I'm now like I'm in a world of pain, partly because of what's happened on the bike, but I've never run as slow as this." And we were maybe running, I don't know, 8 minute miles or something at the time. It's like, "I've never run as slowly as this in training ever. My body doesn't know how to do it. I've done all these tempo workouts and track workouts, and I've realized my body doesn't know how to run slowly." And that's a massive, and that was a light bulb for me. It was like, I owe that guy a beer, actually, because it was the sort of like, oh, okay. Yeah, because we all push ourselves hard in training to go faster, but we neglect the obvious thing, which is we've got to train specifically for what we're most likely to be doing on race day. I just want to talk about baselining and how that becomes specific for moving into the race-specific block. So we mentioned earlier, firstly on the swim, that we'll stop using the CSS test. And so one of the things we're going to do for testing is every 4 weeks, we're going to do a repeated 100 session. And this, I think, is the best benchmarking session that an athlete can do. We swim repeated 100s. We'll start by doing 10 by 100, and it's on a 5-second turnaround. Ideally swim bilaterally and just see what you come in on, and try and make every one of those 100s the same as the one before. And that's a really good benchmark session. We start at 10 by 100, we can go 15, 20, work up to 40 by 100. There will then be no surprises come race day for people who are doing half Ironman, people who are doing full Ironman. Because if you're doing a half Ironman and you've done 20 by 100 on a 5-second turnaround bilaterally, coming in the same pace every time, that's going to be about the same pace and effort you're going to swim on race day. And so then the training session becomes the testing session. You don't have to try harder. And I love the fact that you do this bilaterally, because that limits how hard you can push yourself. For most people, swimming bilaterally it's like a natural pace cap. And it means you can then do exactly what you described earlier. You have to focus on your technique to try and go faster rather than focusing on trying to go harder. Because if you try and go harder, you have to breathe more often than bilaterally. And for everybody other than kids who swam as kids, swimming bilaterally is a really good way to limit the pace you can swim at, make sure you stay aerobic.
And this is going to be really challenging for athletes. When we look through the data of a lot of the swims of the athletes we do, we see at least a 3 to 5 second deviation between, call it 100 meters in terms of pace. And that's okay. And they're honing their craft, and it's going to take time to get really consistent. But we should be at a point, regardless of your pace, whether you're a 2:30 minute swimmer, 2 minute swimmer, 1:30 minute swimmer per 100, you should have the ability to replicate that stroke and that pace for 100 meters, 100 meters after 100 meters after 100 meters. And if you can't, you're going to have to ask yourself, why? Is it to do with my pacing strategy, or is it to do with a technique fault? Or are you changing your breathing pattern? Something must be happening, because you should be able to come in on the clock within a second each time. And I know to a fairly novice swimmer, that just is mind-blowing. And I remember the moment I had that when I was talking to the swim team in Oxford, and they... 1 second deviation for them was a total failure. And it just blew my mind. And actually, over the years, I understood that without looking at your watch, you can come in within a second. So call it 2 minutes, either 2:01 or you're on 2 minutes for 100 meters every single time, whether it's your first rep or your last. And it's not better to do 1:50 for the first rep, and then slowly but surely things break down and your pace goes. Your pace kind of falls off. You have to learn to be able to have that consistent 2 minute swim in this example every single rep. And that really tests technique more than anything. The moment your technique breaks down, suddenly you get to try and make up time through effort. And we know that effort doesn't equal speed. So you've got to be really, really meticulous with your technique. And this will be a really interesting one, I think, when we look through the data of our own athletes.
Yeah. And I think you're right. I think the way to look at this for athletes is that's where you want to get to for the last test you do before you go and do your A race. You want it to be to the point where you're confident, you're coming in on the same time on the clock every time. Work towards that as the holy grail, because it shifts the focus then away from how fast can I swim, and it moves it onto how repeatable can I make my stroke every single time. And that's really the place to get people to. So that's why we make the shift away from a CSS test and towards a more endurance-based swim test. When we're talking about FTP testing on the bike in our race specific training phase, we want to be doing the test outdoors. And it's really important that the closer you get to race day, the more of your riding gets done outdoors. For almost everyone we work with, there's a difference between their indoor and their outdoor FTP. It doesn't matter what that is, and it doesn't mean you're necessarily a better rider if you put more outdoors, more power outdoors, and vice versa. But know what your outdoor numbers are. Then when we're working out percentages going forward into races, we can be really, really clear about what a reasonable power number is. Because otherwise, if you've got a power meter and you're not using it and you've got nothing to benchmark it against, you literally may as well not have that power meter. And I'm always drawn back to that story of the athlete from last year who's no longer with us, who didn't have the race that they wanted at the end of the summer. And when we dug into all of the data, it turns out that the FTP tests hadn't been done. The outdoor FTP tests hadn't been done. And so the percentages of FTP the athlete were riding to in the event, we didn't know whether it was accurate or not because it wasn't relative to anything. And it's just so, so essential. It goes hand in hand with having your power meter calibrated, doing the outdoor FTP test. So my tip for people here is to enter a 10-mile time trial. If you've got one organized near you, use that as your outdoor FTP test. Ride it in the kit you're going to race in, and then off you go and you've got your outdoor FTP number. And I think the only other thing to mention in there is run testing as you get closer to event day becomes less and less relevant. And entering run races becomes more and more risky the closer you get to your, especially if you race an Ironman, racing a 5K is completely irrelevant to your race. You know, you're much better off using your runs at e-pace and looking at your watch as we described and comparing your heart rate as you run. That's the thing to start focusing on rather than how fast of a runner am I? It's how consistently can I run at that relatively, you know, aerobic zone 2 heart rate. That's going to be the marker of how well you can go and perform in your run come race day.
I think that all, I think it gives a kind of good idea of where the athlete should be heading over the next couple of weeks at least. The only thing that we specifically haven't spoken about, and I think it's worth reiterating, is as you get race specific, you can start to bring in your nutrition and hydration plan into that. We want to be race specific, mm-hmm. not only in sessions you do, but how you fuel them. So I know that a lot of athletes haven't been using the products necessarily that they'll be using on race day over the winter. Absolutely fine. We understand that. But as you once you enter the kind of 16 to 20 week block for Ironman, at least, you want to start preparing everything to do with nutrition. So that's the actual products, but also the ability to train the gut to make sure that you absorb that. And we had a really interesting conversation with the guys at PFNH a couple of weeks ago, I think it was, who stated that it takes on average 8 to 10 weeks for the gut to be fully trained to be able to absorb and process the nutrition that we're asking. So if you use that as a flag in the sand, work backwards from that to know that you actually need to try and test which products work for you and how you're going to carry them and how much liquid you want, gels, all that stuff. Because then once you have a plan A, you can actually test and train your gut for that period of 10 weeks pre-event. Don't leave it too long. And I know it's only February right now, but time goes really quickly when you get race specific. So as you're doing the race specific bike sessions and run sessions, start to fuel them as if you're testing and getting ready for race day.
Absolutely. And for people who want to go back, they can go back and check that out in the archive. We've got 5 or 6 chats going back over the last couple of years, really informative talks with the team at Precision Fuel and Hydration that really illustrate, you know, the depth of the science that they understand and how they can help athletes out. But you're dead right. As you shift towards your race-specific training plan, we need to start thinking more and more about race-specific fueling plans. And I think that's especially true for the athletes. The more focused on performance you are, the more importance you've got to place on that fueling thing as well. So if people want to find out more about Precision Fuel and Hydration, you can go over to precisionfuelandhydration.com. You can use the free fueling and hydration planning tool on their website. That's really good. It'll give you a really good feel for how much carbohydrate, electrolyte, and fluid you and your body are going to need for the events that you're trying to do. So you can basically refine that strategy in training, just like Chris said. You can also book a free one-to-one video consultation with their athlete support team, and they'll talk you through everything that you need to know, help you come up with a nutrition plan for the race, and you can then practice that in training. So there's a link for that in the show notes. And also over at teamoxygenetic.com, we've got the most comprehensive triathlon coaching program for busy age groupers. You can check out the details of our coaching on our website. And if it sounds good, please book a call with us and see if you'd be a good fit for joining the team. Let's see how we can best help you achieve your triathlon goals for the coming season. So remember, there's links in the show notes. You don't have to remember them. Until next week, have a great, safe training and racing week. I'm Coach Rob Wilby, and you've been listening to the Oxygen Addict Podcast.